I'm going to start and then turn it over to John. So I'm pleased to be talking to you about this. Some of you have heard quite a bit about our benefit risk project. My leg is asleep. I have pins and needles. Sorry. I have a three-year-old, and she just recently got pins and needles for the first time, and she said, it feels like when you turn the TV on, all that fuzz, that's what my leg feels like. That's what my leg feels like right now. So I'm going to try not to dance around up here. So I'm going to start this, and then I'm going to hand it over to my collaborator, John Bridges. John has been interested for a very long time in patient-centered research, and I think we sort of threw him in the deep end, but he's been an excellent partner, and we could definitely not have done this project without him, so I'm very pleased he's here today. I'm going to sort of lay the groundwork, talk about why we did the survey and a little bit about how it was set up, and then John's going to present the data to you. Sorry, God, my leg feels really bad. Okay.
Start jumping.
I need to jump. So to acknowledge again, this was a group effort. We do have co-authors. So there is a woman, Eileen Holland, at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, as well as Hadar Sheffer, who is a collaborator from PPMD. But this was really quite a group effort. The PPMD staff were instrumental in getting this put together very quickly and coming up with a survey that I think you all will agree is very interesting and quite effective. So in terms of the survey, again, the intent, so you just heard a description of how the FDA has asked for particular sorts of engagement. And so we're calling this aggressive collaboration. So we're trying to go to the FDA with the kind of data that they've asked for, and our hope is the kind of data that they will use. You know, stories about what it's like to live with Duchenne are very important, and it's very important that they understand that. But, you know, they really do want an aggregated set of data that's in a format that is acceptable and familiar to them to make decisions on a broader level. And so that was our intent, is to come to them with a really robust study that's been done in a very scientifically valid way that will inform them with the sort of data that you know, that they're used to and that they expect. So why study preferences? This is very familiar to the parents in the room, but for, you know, the clinicians and the researchers, here's a quote from a parent. We have a current study, and I'll tell you, it's not a study, a current project going on, which is Tell Your Story, and I'll tell you at the end how you can participate in this. But we asked people, if you could tell the FDA anything you want, what would you want them to know? And this is one quote that we have. A lot of parents have this feeling that parents should be able to get the information about the potential benefits and the potential risks of a drug and should be able to make an informed decision together with their family, their healthcare provider, and their children, and that this is an intensely personal decision that parents should have more latitude in. So this is just one example of a quote from a parent. So in terms of the aims of the survey, we have current aims, and then we have future aims. So some of this survey has been, the survey is done, but some of the analysis has been done, but some of the analysis is ongoing. This is very complicated analyses. In terms of what we have done to date, we have identified the treatment preferences of parents and guardians, and yes, this is the only group we've looked at so far. We do certainly believe that we need to get a much broader perspective, including, and most importantly, from individuals who have Duchenne muscular dystrophy themselves about what their treatment tolerance and risk preferences, I said that backwards, treatment preferences and risk tolerance is in terms of therapies. But this is the group we started with, and we wanted to prioritize as well their Duchenne-related worries. So the FDA, in addition to being interested in understanding better about benefit risk, we're also interested in understanding more about the lived experience and what the burden and the effect of having Duchenne in your family is. So we additionally ask questions about worries, and you'll hear more about that in a minute. Future aims, we also have the ability from this data to look at particular treatments and to explore which particular treatment profiles parents and guardians would be willing to use, and also to look at potential differences. So maybe some of the things that might predict particular levels of tolerance for risk in different types of populations, so among the people who we surveyed. So how did this survey work? Some of you in the room may have taken it. It's a very, very complicated survey. I'm incredibly indebted. We all are incredibly indebted to the parents who actually took this survey. It was not a minimal time commitment, and it was quite difficult, I think, for a lot of people to wrap their head around it. In fact, we got feedback from many people who took the survey. Just, you know, people sent emails, some who completed the survey, and some of those people said things like, I had never had to think through these issues before, and it was quite difficult, but many people felt like it was actually a worthwhile experience just to force themselves to think carefully about this idea of risk versus benefit in therapeutics. So in terms of obtaining information, we, of course, wanted background information from the parents and guardians and about their child with Duchenne. So we have the typical questions about demographics and how much, you know, what people's income level is and all that kind of typical stuff you see in a survey. But we also asked about the child's stage of illness. We asked about things about who takes care of the child. So we have lots of interesting information about the child and about the parent, which will be useful to be able to give a feel for who these folks were. The first aim of this was to look at those specific treatment preferences. So we used a choice experiment, and that was used to identify which features were best and worst. So people got a treatment that we presented to them, and you'll see an example in a minute, and we asked them, of this treatment, describe what's the best thing and what's the worst thing. We did a similar thing with the worries. So we gave people a list of worries that we anticipated would all be important worries for them, but we asked them to actually prioritize. So in the past 7 days, which has been the most significant worry for you and which has been the least significant worry for you? So, you know, again, I think an important thing about this kind of survey is that we did set it up so that everything on it was important, but we forced people to say what was most important or least important or best and worst. We recruited for this survey primarily through PPMD and Duchenne Connect Registry. We also did snowball recruiting, and what that means is people sort of tell other people, and you end up with things like on social media, you end up with people talking in communities about it. So we did have some recruitment in that way as well. People who participated had to have at least one child who was living with Duchenne. They had to be in the United States, and that's, you know, again, this is the first phase. The importance of living in the United States was that we are intending at this point to inform the FDA. And, of course, they had to be able to complete a survey that was online and in English. And this was a study that was exempted by an IRB called Western IRB. So to give you a little bit of information about who took the survey, we had 119 parents who completed the entire survey. Their average age was 43, about 44 years old, and the vast majority of them have one affected child. The average age of the child with Duchenne is about 12, and about 20% of those children had in their lifetime experienced a life-threatening emergency that caused the parent to worry that the child would die. So this gives us, I was interested in this question primarily to get a feel for maybe how relevant an issue of a significant life-threatening risk might be to parents, anticipating parents who had had that experience before might find that more salient. So that's just a bit. We have a lot more of information about the population of parents and the children, but at this point I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to John Bridges, and he's going to talk you through the very specific aims and the results we got from the treatment experiment and from the worry experiment. And then I'm going to come back up. You guys get to see me again. I'm going to come back up and talk about the conclusions and the next steps. So, John?
Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak. I'm a scientist. I study preferences. I work in a variety of diseases. I have been doing some work with the FDA, thinking about some methods to look at quantitative benefit risk and incorporating preferences. I've done also worked with several international agencies to do this type of method. So I come from this from a real methodological point of view. I'm not a content person. I don't know the content that I'm analyzing. What I'm trying to do is give a vehicle that could essentially take some qualitative statements, or what I call the patient and parent's voice, and convert it into a way that is scientifically valid and that is in a presentation format that is something that is easy for the FDA to consider and visualize and to potentially impact the decision-making processes. As we said, the first aim was to focus on treatment preferences. Preferences here are essentially defined as a notion of would I take one treatment over another treatment? And we think about the kind of incremental differences between those treatments. Also, there's another type of preference, which is, would I take the treatment at all? And that's something to do with the risk tolerance that Holly talked about. And we've got that built into the analysis, but we're not going to talk about that today. We worked with parents and stakeholders, similar to the people that are in the room, maybe some of the people in the room, to identify a pool of treatment features or attributes. And these were the things that could define a possible treatment that's in pipeline or is even possible to come through. And using a statistically valid experimental design, we identified 18 potential hypothetical treatments. And from these treatments varied in a very particular way, such that there was no statistical relationship between those treatments. And then we asked the respondents to go through them and look at the 6 attributes that were in each one of those treatments and identify which one was best and which one was worse. These are the attributes that were settled upon through a deliberation process that involved engagement of patients and industry and other stakeholders, including clinicians. Slowing the progression of muscle weakness. We see each one of these is populated with 3 levels. So we call the larger item an attribute, and then it could take on. We do not know the drugs that will come available, but some drugs may stop, slow, or have no change. Another benefit is the effect of having additional lifespan. It may be possible in the future that drugs will have an effect on lifespan. Another aspect which is a benefit, we talked about it a little bit, is the ability to have post-market data, not just when it comes up for registration. It might come through with a quick registration, but then we could monitor that drug. What is the value of that information? Do we appreciate that having more information is more valuable in a way that it kind of decreases risks that are immeasurable or poorly measured in a clinical trial? Then some of the other types of side effects that we might get from a drug, nausea, a risk of bleeds, which is sometimes called a hemorrhagic stroke. We're talking about here a risk. We don't know the numbers on that. We're just talking categorically the severity of that risk. And again, with a heart arrhythmia, possibility of having an arrhythmia, or one that may potentially even lead to death via this. But again, we don't know what it's populated with. We're doing it qualitatively with these statements. This is an example of the choice task. It differs. We're not just going to say, let's rate each one of these out of 5 points or something like that. There would actually be a large number of comparisons that we would have to do there. This is one of the 18 profiles that were generated. This is not a drug that's in development. It's something that the computer has chosen to understand the preferences. And then the respondent is asked to, for this particular profile, what is the best element of this and what is the worst element? And I think what we were finding was sometimes we would have the best drug there and try and force people to say, out of all the best options, this is the dream drug. Still then, what is the best part of it and what is the worst part of it? Likewise, we would give them the worst possible drug. Still then, we had to identify these best and worst. And through this repetition, we could identify through a statistical model, and the type of model that's underpinning this is a type of regression that actually received the Nobel Prize in economics. We're not going to show any of those equations, but this is very cutting-edge statistical analysis. And this is the type of picture that we can generate from the responses by combining the 18 responses here. We see the 6 attributes going across the page there, and then the particular levels that are taken on. If we look, the first one there is the effect on muscle weakness. We see that the very stopping or slowing progression has a lot of value compared to a benchmark. Here, an individual item doesn't have value. It's the difference between items that generates value. If I can move a drug that would have improvements in this muscle weakness, what would be the benefit? And, of course, the major benefit is the slowing. And then there's an incrementalism when we could think about the stopping. But we're really looking for one that slows there. Again, there's this kind of what we call convexity relationship. giving some additional lifespan, very, very good. That's what we're looking for here. And then it might taper off in terms of some demand, but that is still the most desirable of that. Even though we talk about we want drugs as much as possible, the respondents did value statistically significant here the duration of post-market data. A drug gets better as it ages, like a wine. The more that it's around and we know about it, it gets better. And there is that. It's not a major feature, and we could think about trading that off against some potential benefits. And then we see the other factors there, the major risk factors, the bleeds, and the arrhythmia are there. Vomiting has a factor there as well. If we took that and took it into a sum and looked at the relative differences within that model, this is a different pictorial looking at within the model what was explaining the variation in the choices. And we see here that almost half the model is associated with the two benefit features, but that is also offset by the two risk, the major risk features, the arrhythmia and the bleeds, because they had potentially life-altering or life-ending consequences. But you see it's pretty balanced. And the notion of this balance and the potential to do simulations with this data to evaluate the benefits and risks to see what would be an acceptable trade-off and potentially move to a model of estimating the net benefit of a drug. Even though it has some potentially risks, we can trade that off and look at the net benefit of the drug. And I think that's where we're going to move to in quantitative benefit risk analysis, is this net benefit analysis. There are other things that are a little bit more complicated and a little bit harder to put into words, and that is the things that parents care about. Traditionally, this is done through qualitative analysis, where we put some quotes. We put one of the quotes up there before. One of the problems, we might say that is well known or that is resonates with many parents, but we can't quantify a qualitative statement. We're going to do a different approach here, where we essentially use a very similar best-worst type of rating system to go through and listen to some statements that were made, and we identified those statements through patient engagements and a pilot, and through some kind of refinement that was essentially brought them down to four domains. Factors that worry parents and caregivers, that are associated with the child's emotions, the child's medical conditions, the family and social well-being, and the parent well-being. So we see that there's kind of a balance here between child factors. These are the child-centred concerns, affect and emotion. And you can see the type of items that were generated here. And I'm sure among the room, people will resonate with different features here, and that was there was no one answer. There was no one concern that everyone had. There is a pattern that we can model, and here are the family-centred concerns. So again, we did a best-worst measurement technique, and here are the statistical results, which I've ordered in a descending order, and they're colour-coded around the different themes. We can see what has come up to the top there is really those medical concerns. The primary thing that we identified was that notion of my child is getting weaker, the right care for my child over time, and my child missing out on opportunities. These are there. And what you see here to the side of that is a enumeration of that in statistical analysis, where we could potentially then go and do some subgroup analysis, as Holly mentioned, focused on these preference vary across different types? Do they change there? And we see some different changes there. One of the issues here, and there could be a little bit of bias with regard to the framing of our experiment, but the emotional aspects and the parent self-care aspects tended to go to the bottom, and that's an area for further exploration of how we can manage that and think about that on your behalf.
Okay. So just to conclude, what we've found is, and this has to be taken within the context of our experiment, because, people could only respond to what we gave them. But within the context of our experiment, we did find that, again, the worries related to the child's illness progression and care were the most significant of the worries within the model. Similarly, stopping or slowing progression of muscle weakness is the one that accounted for most of the variance. So this is the, you saw that pie graph. This is what's sort of driving the parents' preferences. And, you know, again, just to reinforce, we gave people stopping and slowing progression. We did not give them getting stronger or a cure. So we only gave parents a moderate level, well, it's actually quite a significant level of benefit, but we didn't go, you know, as high as we could have with potential benefit. We also did show you again that we did find that the presence of side effects and risk could be compensated for by a treatment that would stop or slow progression. So people were willing to tolerate those side effects and risks. However, parents didn't have unlimited risk tolerance, which is, you know, not surprising and quite reassuring that, you know, if we gave parents even the best benefits that we had in this simulated treatment, if we also gave them all of the worst risks, that was not okay. So they're willing to accept some level of serious risk, but not all of the serious risks that we could give them. So I think this is very important and meaningful data. What we hope to do now is to continue the analysis of the data like Dr. Bridges described. We also are continuing to engage with the FDA, and as you heard, we have an upcoming meeting about their acceptability of this data and their interest in what they would like to see moving forward. We do plan to refine the survey and to do a second survey of a larger group, and you know, not just a larger group of parents, but also a larger group that includes different folks, most specifically the people living with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And we'll continue to do community input through things like focus groups as well as the survey. So we really look forward to your engagement in ongoing steps of this project. And, you know, like I said, these surveys are not easy to take. They take quite a bit of time. They're very complicated. But I do hope in the upcoming months, if you see something coming across the PPMD website or in your email or in a newsletter about a survey, that you will take the time to do this, because this is incredibly important information that we get across to the FDA. So thank you very much for your time and attention, and thank you, John, for collaborating with us on this project.